finish my visit.
Please take your seats. If Elizabeth Detweiler can hear me, could she come up for a moment, please?
These are clean?
Yes, they are.
Oh, sorry. I thought that because they're wet, so I assume they're not.
After I clean them.
Everybody will take their seats. My name is Daniel Serwer. I'm Vice President for Peace and Stability Operations here at the U.S. Institute of Peace. And it's a particular pleasure for me to welcome you and to convene this second panel, which will address the critical question of political progress and lack thereof in Iraq. I want to start just by wholeheartedly thanking my colleague Randall Rahim, who has put together this morning's activities and who, with great foresight and vision, realized that we had a fabulous group of Iraqis resident either in or near near enough to Washington, and put together these two really extraordinary panels. I think you've already heard in the first panel an extraordinary degree of courage, of eloquence, and of intelligence. I am continually amazed at the human resources that are available. I think the second panel is, we'll try to be the first panel's equal, let's put it that way, in courage, eloquence, and intelligence. I sometimes am a little bit jealous of the way in which some Iraqis speak my own language. I wish I could even begin to speak Arabic. It would be a great pleasure. I think it's fair to say, by way of introduction, that there is a sense in Washington of disappointment in political progress in Iraq. And in that sense, the burden of proof is on our panelists, after a fashion. And what we need to know is why does political progress appear to be slow? How can it be speeded up? And I want to remind you before we start of Michael Gordon's question to the previous panel, which was, will making the American presence unconditional help with political progress, or will outlining a time horizon, as it's been called, will that encourage Iraqis to reach the sorts of political agreements that appear to be needed? We're looking for ways to make this happen. I think, despite our very sharp differences in this political season, there is an emerging consensus in Washington that America needs its troops, and it can't continue to have the force levels that it has had in the past in Iraq. So you help us understand how what are the pressure points that can push political process a bit ahead. And to address those issues, we have three good friends. I'm going to call first on Faisal Istrabadi, who served his native country well as former deputy permanent representative of the Iraqi mission to the United Nations. He is now associate director of the Center for Constitutional Democracy at Indiana University. And I want to say that Faisal's not new to the Institute. He's appeared here a number of times and always has impressed us with his insights into the situation in Iraq, as well as his insights into the situation here. I'll go next to Karim al-Mousawi, who is al-Mousawi. I should get it right after all these years. Al-Mousawi. Karim has long represented the Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq under its various names here in Washington as well as elsewhere. He's been a participant with us in a number of previous public events here, but I must say also has provided a good deal of quiet guidance and help to USIP and various other activities as well, and we're very grateful for that. We'll finish with Hassan Al-Attiyah, who is temporarily in the United States, at least I think temporarily.
Today only.
He leaves today. Well, we're grateful to have you with us in this last moment. He is now at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He is renowned, I would say, in Iraqi circles for his work during the Saddam Hussein regime to document what was happening with the quite extraordinary Iraqi file that he published for many years. I don't remember how many, and did an extraordinary job of helping the Iraqi diaspora, of helping Iraqis generally to understand what was happening and to make transparent things that otherwise would have been quite extraordinarily opaque. We're going to try to finish up in a way that will allow for questions and comments, and we will try to allow some questions to the other panel as well. Let us begin with you, Faisal.
Thank you, Dan. It is a great pleasure to be back at the U.S. Institute of Peace, particularly with such a distinguished set of speakers, who indeed are fabulous. I, unfortunately, as you will soon discover, am the exception to that that proves the rule that the other speakers are indeed fabulous. I recently accompanied my a mentor, I guess, and former boss, Dr. Adnan Pachachi, at an event in which he spoke at the Wilson Center. He was introduced by Congressman Hamilton, whose first words were, this is Congressman Hamilton, Chairman Hamilton's words, first words, "The discourse in the United States on Iraq has been shallow, narrowly focused, and partisan. I don't think that the intervening months of the election cycle in this country would have improved Chairman Hamilton's, I guess Director Hamilton now, assessment of that discourse. I wish that I could tell you that the discourse in Iraq on the role of the United States was more sublime. But unlike my good friend Qubad, I no longer am an ambassador from Iraq, so I can speak my own mind about these issues. And now, unlike the last time that I appeared at this podium. It's interesting that the panel began with the constitutional issues, because that's exactly where I intended to start as well. But I'm going to start on a note of disagreement on the question of constitutionalism, a note of dissent, to use a judicial phrase, in respect to the Constitution and its centrality to Iraqi life. I regard myself, by the way, as an Iraqi constitutional lawyer, having been a principal drafter of the interim constitution. So it is perhaps odd that it is someone who does regard himself as a constitutional lawyer who stands here to tell you that in my judgment, the Iraqi constitution is in no way central to the Iraqi polity today. And it is so for a very simple reason. It is in no way a compact for the country. It cannot be. When the second largest ethno-confessional group in the country rejects the document by nearly 100%, in no way can we speak with respect to Mr. Talabani. In no way can we speak of having a compact, a national compact. Do we have a constitutional text? Yes. Is it important? Yes. But do we have a national compact? Absolutely not, in my judgment. And this is a central fact operating in Iraq today, that we have a polity within Iraq which believes there's a national compact, and another polity which does not. In my opinion, therefore, by definition, we don't have such a document, a national compact. Not because I say so, but because a significant part of the Iraqi polity doesn't view itself as being bound by such a compact. Now, why is this important to the topic of our panel, which is what advice do we have for the next administration? Well, one of the driving forces in the political discussion here in this country is, are the Iraqis living up to their constitution or not? Now, this is an issue which, therefore, we need to address, and to do so, I'll try to be brief. One of the candidates to one of the four elective offices that are at stake in November made it a part of his election promises, whatever, that the Iraqi constitution ought to be, he always boasts that he's the only one in Washington who's read the Iraqi constitution, and that the Iraqi constitution should be fully implemented, by which he means that we should devolve powers to the various regions. Well, with all respect, a careful reading of the Iraqi constitution demands no such thing. It recognizes that the Kurdistan regional government exists and that it has constitutionally protected status, and that vis-a-vis the Kurdistan regional area, or the Kurdistan region, there is a federal relationship between the KRG and Baghdad. Okay. No one wants to interfere with that. But vis-a-vis the rest of the country, there is absolutely no mandate for federalization, none whatsoever. There is for decentralization. Indeed, even within the KRG, there's supposed to be decentralization. But for the rest of the country, there is no mandate for symmetric federalism, so that in a place like Khan Yunis, which is not within the KRG, not yet, it is, in fact, constitutionally now governed from Baghdad. Polls have shown consistently that Iraqis outside Kurdistan overwhelmingly reject federalism. Now, that may be changing now, but as of the last set of polls, which were released some time ago, nearly a year ago now, two-thirds of Iraq's Arab population in the southern governorates rejected federalism, and over 90% in western or central Iraq rejected federalism. Now, these are things that we have to take into account with respect to what should the role of the United States government be in respect to enforcing the Iraqi constitution. My advice there is hands off. This is an Iraqi process. Even with respect to the benchmarks, which in my judgment were counterproductive, my advice to the United States government is hands off. If the French had made it a condition of their support of the colonists that they adequately resolve by then prevailing European standard the issues of slavery, which is to say that they abolish slavery, that they adequately resolve the issue of federal assumption of state sovereign debt, and that they create a Bank of the United States before the French would intercede to help you or to continue to help you in your effort to gain independence from the British, you would still be Her Britannic Majesty's most loyal subjects. Because it took you 100 years to resolve the issue of slavery and another 100 years to resolve the issue of states' rights, civil rights. And yet we're expected on an American timetable to resolve fundamental issues that will govern how Iraqis rule themselves for the next 50 years. You can't have a hydrocarbon law every 3 years because foreign corporations and Iraq will need tens of billions of dollars of investment in its oil infrastructure. Foreign corporations will not invest in Iraq until there's political stability there. And that political stability cannot be dictated by an American timetable. The question, therefore, from an American administration's point of view, isn't should we stay in Iraq for the brown of the Iraqis' eyes, as we say, but rather, what are American interests, precisely where Rand started us this morning? The American interests, I would argue, are twofold. One, to secure the gains made against, at least twofold, it's multifold, and I know oil, but I only have whatever's left of my 15 minutes, so I'll only talk about two. One, to secure the gains, which are reversible, but which have been substantial in the fight of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. For those who say that Al-Qaeda was not a factor in Iraq before 2003, I say you're right. It was not. For those who say that that Al-Qaeda has never been a factor in Iraq, I say, account to me then for the tens, if not hundreds of thousands of Iraqis blown up by Al-Qaeda suicide bombers. Tell Al-Qaeda that in Iraq, that Al-Qaeda has nothing to do with Iraq. So I think, hopefully once we get past what Americans call the silly season, we can have a mature conversation about not what happened historically in 2003, but where we have been and where we are now, and whether those gains are reversible or not. The second interest, pardon me.
Sorry.
The second interest the United States has, thank you. The second interest the United States has in Iraq right now is to control the influence of Iran in Iraq. And I don't say that only as an Iraqi, although I do say it as an Iraqi, but because it is in the vital United States national interest. The next president will have to deal with the nuclear issue in Iran. A collapsing Iraqi state, which is what we face with a premature American withdrawal, in my judgment, will be most counterproductive, to use diplomatic language. It will be a disaster for the United States and for the vital interests of the United States in confronting the possibility of a nuclear-armed Iran, which nobody in the Middle East wants to see. And this, I think, is the point. Regretfully, we have not been building Iraqi institutions in Iraq over the last 5 years. Not the United States during its period of colonial rule in Iraq, a huge mistake, and not successive Iraqi governments. Regretfully, what we have built are institutions of the political elites in Iraq. And what happens in Iraq is that a party gets a particular ministry. That ministry becomes the property of that party. With respect, this is my observation. It functions as, and there are exceptions to this, and I must say, Ms. Barwari's ministry was one of those exceptions. But unfortunately, there are too few exceptions. And if Ms. Barwari, well, I won't put words in her mouth, but I will tell you that's my judgment. And there are others. I think the foreign ministry is an exception. But there are central ministries dealing with the security in Iraq, where individual parties have taken over those ministries. And though that is something that the United States can be, I think, a vital interlocutor with us in attempting to reverse this process. I don't know how much time I have. Let me spend the rest of the time I have working on talking about the election. We have, I think, in Iraq, thankfully, gotten past the point where political change occurs through coup d'etat and this kind of nonsense. Hopefully we're past that. I believe we are. The history that Judge Raleigh talked about, hopefully we're beyond that. Now we are at the point where elections are indeed the way to secure political change in the country. But what kind of elections? What would you call your elections? And they've been contested enough here in this country over the last two or three political cycles. What would you think of elections in your country if the Republicans and Democrats controlled competing militias that operated in your streets? This is what Iraqis confront. Now, it's a better problem to confront than Saddam Hussein and his absolutist rule, but I will note that the United Nations certified that the last set of Iraqi elections were free and fair, reasonably free and fair. Those are the talismanic words. It's never free and fair, reasonably free and fair. Well, I'm a lawyer. Reasonable is in the eye of the beholder. But they made that determination sitting in Amman, Jordan, because the situation in Baghdad was too dangerous for them to set up an inspection regime in Baghdad and in the polling stations in the country. Let's go back to the Constitution, with all respect. The Constitution of Iraq was nearly defeated by a vote of 75,000. Had 75,000 votes switched in Mosul governorate, the Constitution would have been defeated there. And we would have had to have started from ground zero. If there were not certain militias of certain political parties operating in Mosul governorate, I am personally convinced the Constitution would have been defeated there. Now, are these the kinds of elections we're going to have in 2009? Or is there a commitment on the part of the United States, which still controls the overwhelming bulk of the security portfolio in the country, notwithstanding, you know, the handover of Anbar recently? Or is the United States committed to securing real elections in the country? In the last elections, the political grouping that I come out of, the grouping that Dr. Patrici is in, suffered the assassination of 13 candidates. Are these the kinds of elections that we can look forward to in 2009, both for provincial elections and for parliamentary elections later in the year, at the end of the year? I will tell you, this administration now, the current administration, has no intention, in my judgment, of securing genuine elections in the country. Will the next administration? One of the mistakes that Iraqis make is in thinking that once you have elections, democracy has effloresced. Surprising to me is the number of Americans serving in important places in their government who have the same view. And this really is the thrust of what faces the next administration. What is the plan for securing the safety of particularly political parties who run political parties who are running in essence to in opposition to the current government? What is the attempt to secure their safety, and what is the plan for securing the safety of the elector, so that you are reasonably certain that the vote that he casts in fact reflects his views and not the views of the militia soldier, one of the millions, not million, millions, every teenager carries a Kalashnikov in Iraq, so it seems. The militia member standing at the corner, that the vote is not his will, but the will of the elector. And I would suggest to you that if no attempt is made to secure that much, the elections will be meaningless, in my judgment. I've probably run out of my 15 minutes, so I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Faisal. Kareem, I'm hoping you will take the floor next.
Thanks, Dan. Good morning. I will focus first on the, actually on the, our recommendations to the administration, and also to take a look on the, what's going on in Iraq today. And I hope to give you some optimistic views after the very dark session that we heard just before. 2 years ago, I said in speech in one of Washington's institutes that Iraq has been suffering from escalating deterioration of seriously situation, security situation. Sectarian violence has increased in the past few months, especially after the explosion of the Samarra Holy Shrine in February of 2006. It has reached a very serious point, threatening the social and political Iraqi infrastructure. Today, we are able to say that an obvious advancement has been achieved in terms of the security situation in Iraq, to the point that we can claim an 80% improvement in general state of security compared to the previous year. There is no doubt that the relationship between the coalition forces and the Iraqi government formed the bottom line and the foundation of success in the Iraqi security actions. Today we speak of political achievement as well, and a stronger social fabric, to the point that we see the relationship between the various factions taking a new form, wherein Sunni groups are speaking of a new Iraq and looking for real participation in the incoming elections. Last Wednesday, the 24th of September, the Iraqi Council of Representatives passed the provincial elections law and beforehand passed a number of legislations. There are further legislations on their way seeking to establish a newfound stability and evolution in the political process. This step can only be taken after improvements in the security and decrease in the level of violence, all of which lead to negotiations between the Iraq and the U.S. About status of forces agreement. At the same time, we must understand that it is the priority for the Iraqi government to begin a serious and earnest economic campaign and to improve its social services and the execution of its functions. The upcoming administration, whatever its orientation, Democratic or Republican, shall inherit from the Bush administration a very important and complicated file. That is the Iraqi issue. The new administration's engagement with this issue demands that it show much patience and understanding of the nature of the Iraqi situation. We believe that the new administration's consultation and closeness to the Iraqi government will give it an original comprehension of the Iraqi situation, different from the general analysis currently being circulated. From this viewpoint, We believe that the following realities mentioned below will give the new American administration a better understanding of the Iraq situation. First, the Iraq problem is one with a history of negative influences. Due to the previous circumstances in the country, which led to a large amount of destruction internally and regionally. Without an understanding of the Iraqi history and its role in shaping the current state of affairs, it is impossible to deal positively with the reality. Iraq should not be led except in cooperation among the three main components, Shia, Sunnis, and the Kurds. For one party to rule others will definitely mean reverting to the old state of affairs and will promise to lead to an unstable Iraq and unstable region. Second, democracy, pluralism, and federalism are the primary principles which could and should govern Iraq. Whereas contemplating a strong ruler with power unified in him or another solution will not solve the crisis, but instead bring further crisis to the country. Yes, we must rely on strong carriers. We must rely on strong carriers as a central base of power that can provide the country with those capable of bringing order to the country. Elections will ensure the rule of majority, and federal government will include the participation of the rest. This format, even though there is little experience with it in Iraq, will nonetheless be the one capable of succeeding in Iraq and serving the region as well. Establishing respect for the Shia majority, as well as respecting the rights of the Kurds and securing their identity and presence and regain their rights, and confirming for the Sunnis that they are still have a strong presence and participation in the country. All of this is necessary. Third, a strong country is necessary in Iraq. Therefore, it is vital to balance a unified strong government with local strong governments. And for there to be harmony between the two, neither the first should quarrel with the second, nor should the second be an obstacle in the work of the first. Fourth, searching for solutions for the present problems should not be at the expense of undermining the already established balances. It is better to have a slow-moving solution which lasts than a quick punch-up solution which quickly dissolves and makes it impossible to build any long-lasting and strategic foundation. The solution taken should include support of different constituents in Iraq in their aiming for lasting lasting equality, including also addressing those issues still hanging, such as Kirkuk and other dispute lands. Five, the relation with the United States should not cause Iraq to depend on different American agendas, but should instead strive to respect an Iraqi agenda. In accordance with what the Iraqi body can truly carry, the American disputes in the region should not become Iraqi disputes. Sixth, the notion of the extended period of the foreign presence has been extensively used to due to the talks about the occupation and the religion, the regional circumstances. Iraq and the United States should search for means to move the state of security beyond its present condition. And the United States should hasten the arming and equipping of the Iraqi armies, forces, security and army, with what it what is needed in order to attain full responsibility of the security issue, which is of utmost importance. In any case, our success in reaching a compromise on the status of forces agreement should condition the removal of the forces troops before the end of 2011. And this demands a strategic vision which will take the security relationship out of its present framework to a newer, more realistic framework. Until reaching the agreement, the relationship between the coalition forces and the Iraqi government must represent a focal point in keeping the security project in Iraq a success. 7. Speed in investments, especially oil sector, and one of the keys in equalization of interests. This common affluence can decrease the tensions between the factions and fulfill the interests of Iraqis. The means to strengthen the strategic relationship between the United States and Iraq are economy, education, social services, and big economic projects, and the presence of international corporations and their banks. Focusing only on the security projects in Iraq will always be accompanied with doubt and instability. It could be accepted by the Kurds because of their current situation, or even by the Sunnis or Shia, but never will full long-term conviction, but rather out of fear of regional instability. This can never be the basis for the formation of the strategic relationships. 9. Iraq and Iran, neighboring countries. Escalation of disputes with Iran as part of a plan of military strategy to confine Iran will only cause further instability in Iraq. Ninth, whether aiming for good relations with the Arab neighbors, Iran or Turkey, must be built upon a correct balance, which would include not entering into the private affairs of Iraq. The proper balance upon which Iraq can engage its regional neighbors should be based on all countries' participation on an equal footing to serve common interests and establishment of peace and security. From that, it is necessary that the United States, opening channels for the Iraqi government with the international community, and in particular the Arab and regional countries, to help in the rebuilding of Iraq's relations. Iraq is a unique country in terms of its diverse relations with neighboring countries. Based on this vision, Americans can understand that Iraq is a bridge between many contradictions within the region. Iraq is not suited to be used for wrestling with the neighbor, with its neighbors. In contrast, Iraq is suitable to be used as a bridge with its neighbors. Thank you.
Thank you, Kareem. Hassan, on your way to the airport,
yes.
Give us your wisdom.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you. And Dan, thank you very much. Always a pleasure to be with you here. USIP has done a great job in Baghdad, and I am one of those who benefit from their help in publishing the Iraqi file in Baghdad. After publishing it 12 years in England, in Baghdad I couldn't survive more than a year, and again I am an exile, or self-exile, as I used to be in the 80s and the 90s. Mr. Sarbadi referred to, I don't have to deal with it. And a written paper that is there about the election, the forthcoming election, and the stumbling blocks. But I would like to seize this opportunity to address it through you, the new American administration. I would say, as an Iraqi, to start with, you don't have to put me in the pigeonhole, the classical ones. I am a secular liberal. If you would like to put me as a Shia or a Sunni or a Kurd, this is your problem. The question is, the new administration, if I am addressing whoever will be the head of the new administration, I would say, look, I, among others who looked at you, the American, that you are a strategic partner to us to get rid of dictatorship. We thought that with your help, you can help us too, on two accounts. First, to protect us against ourselves, and to protect us from our neighbors. And with your know-how, we can be the South Korea of the Middle East. That was my understanding. Unfortunately, those who were in control thought otherwise. They thought they know better than us, and they came to Iraq with the preconceived ideas. They thought that we are Shia, Sunni, Kurd only, and in the name of democracy, they thought 80% is enough. That is Shia and Kurd, that's enough. And the Sunni, they have to accept as such. Forgetting that this equation is the root of the cause of the problem in Iraq. Unfortunately, in their dealing with the Shia, fine, deal with the Shia. I come from the south of Iraq. But why did you choose, empowered those Shia who were trained and brought and everything in Iran? Why did you choose those? Why not the other Shia? And then, in your report a week ago by the Pentagon, claiming the situation in Iraq is getting better but still fragile, and Iran is the source of trouble. Mr. President, you have to ask yourself, what empowered Iran to be such a decisive force in Iraq? It is your mistakes. You, inadvertently, you supported those who work with the Iranian and those who instantly turned the mosque and Husseiniyat into new party organizations, and they controlled the south, and their militia turned into in the police force, and they were responsible, according to your reports, the death squads which targeted whoever disagreed with them. This approach, by misconceived ideas with unintended consequences, then you start rushing what is the constitution and the election. As Mr. Talbani, President Talbani said once in London to Blair, the way we conducted things in Iraq, like the English double-decker bus. They come three at a time, and then we wait an hour to see the other one to come. So we had election to election, a constitution, in one go. And imagine, did you in the United States have your constitution being wrapped up within a few months? In South Africa, it took them 7 years to reach a conciliation. And then, Mr. President, believe me, reconciliation should have been the first priority, and then the election, then the constitution, because the basis of it, national reconciliation. And we ask you to help us from ourselves. But unfortunately, instead of the Kurds telling them that now you have to end your tribalism, end your own fiefdom, end your own partisanship, and empower the people, actually you render the power to the two main parties. And actually in Kurdistan now, it is ruled by one party system in Erbil and one party system in Soleimani. I don't want to argue with any Kurdish friend, because I am supporter of the Kurdish people. I am in touch with them. I know how they feel, and we can be disagree without being disagreeable. Also, another factor with the Shia incident, they were the majority in Iraq, yes, numerically, but the Shia is not a political party. You cannot lump the Shia into one entity. There are city dwellers, there are countryside, the south is different, the Euphrates from the Tigris are different, there are Shia of Iranian origin, Shia of Arab origin. How come you devise something new called Shia, and then if you deal with me, you have to put me in one category, as happened actually with me, with a senior American official. Two, if you consider the Sunni simply to lump sum all those being Sunni as the enemy and victimize them, what you have done, you were so good in creating enemy and uniting them. By dissolving the army, you simply push them into rebellion. By considering any Sunni as the threat to them, you push them into uniting. A right policy would have been to incorporate them, and then also the Shia, instead of as a majority to encompass all and to be magnanimous and to feel that now we don't have to fear anything, we should not make the mistakes of the past. Now in the name of the majority, unfortunately they were rather selfish, and here is the problem. They played into your game, into this highly polarized society. The constitution was a pact between the Shia Islamist party and the two Kurdish parties in the following manner: you take Kurdistan and have anything to do with it, it's your fiefdom, and allow us to have our Shiistan in the south, 9 provinces, and we do what we want to do with it, and this is democracy. This is actually was tantamount to breaking Iraq. What we unite as Iraqis, believe me, I am a student of Iraq, believe me, it's only the land and the resources of the land. Otherwise, we are different in language, we differ in cultures, we differ in religion, we differ in so many aspects. The question is, how are we going to live in this land? Are we going to find a formula, or only a dictator will rule us, or only one party will rule us? How are we going to live? This is something difficult for us. We need your help. The help you can afford us will be highly respected when you play the role of facilitator, not the dictator, or not the one who will impose her on us. That role, I hope, the new administration will play in Iraq, and we need it. Now the Kurd leadership, they don't listen to us. Believe me, I know them. They are my friends. I respect them. They don't. They listen to you. They listen to you. Yeah. And the last two incidents, the Kurdish leadership, unfortunately, as they are proved, they proved themselves Iraqis by committing the same mistakes of the others. First, in their nationalistic attitude, the Arab nationalists adopted it in the past and used to call the Kurds insurgent, Usat, and all the things. Now, the government is calling the Arab Sunnis insurgent, Usat, and they are terrorists and all these names. Here again, the Kurdish leadership will actually find that, and only such a country like the United States can help us bringing together. Unfortunately, the Kurdish leadership alienated not only the Iraqi Arabs, but alienated the Turkmen, other minorities, also alienated all their neighbors, for heaven's sake. Save them, save the Kurdish people from being isolated in such a situation whereby they live in an island thinking that you, United States, will save them from all their neighbors. This is not right for the people of Kurdistan, not the leaders. The leaders are maybe happy with what they have. Now we come to my other advice to you. Iraq, you thought you can do it yourself, you were the sole player, unfortunately you failed. With the more than 30,000 wounded and maimed, nearly 4,200 killed, now it is time to reconsider. The problem in Iraq, in addition to the how to deal with us, how to deal with the neighbors. The British dealt with Iraq when they were the sole power in the Middle East, and they had difficulties and have to learn from mistakes. Now you are not the sole power in the Middle East, you have to recognize your neighbors. You have to, one of you, whether McCain or Obama will be in power, you have to ask yourself, what going to do with Iran? Going to fight it? Good luck. Do it. Show us how you can fight it. Do you have the money? Do you have the resources? Fine. If you don't have this, what is the option? Here I would say, in the last few minutes, is the following proposal. First, you have to have a regional approach, in the sense it is intertwined our relations. Iran has so many problems with you, not only Iraq. But maybe Iraq could be as a bridge, as my friend said now. But not other things. Then Syria. Syria could be useful, but Syria have to make sure that you don't want to regime change. Then the Saudis, they have afraid of the Shiistan in the south. You have to consider in that. So they are intertwined. Two, in region approach, you have to take the worries of Turkey, of the Syrian and others. This cannot be taken by piecemeal. It has to be a package. In this package, everyone should find in it something more beneficial than he loses. In that sense, he will accept a compromise. The Iranians should compromise on the nuclear file. They should compromise on Hezbollah. They should compromise on the Palestinian issue by accepting what the Palestinians accept. The Syrian should accept that for them to remain in power, they have to cooperate in preventing infiltration in Iraq and by pushing others into reconciliation. All these forces, once they meet a common ground, you have to start not by getting power in the seat in January, you have to start running from 5th of November by working hard in preparing the ground, especially if those who give themselves, which I unwise as far as I'm concerned, by saying in 16th month we withdraw, you have to work hard to make use of the time to make your withdrawal from Iraq practical. And here I will suggest the following thing. Once you convene such a regional conference, you cannot succeed in this without preparation. You cannot succeed with this without international help. You have to win the Russian. You have to win the Chinese. You cannot win the Russian by putting missiles next door to them. You have to treat them as equals. You have to treat them as partners. Enough, a bit of humility will further American standing in the world, and less arrogance will be to the benefit of the American standing in the world. Once you win the European and the Russian and Chinese and the Indian, then with the international auspices, this conference will take place, and this conference, only this conference, can call upon all Iraqis for Iraqi conference. All of them. Only 2 days ago, American general in Afghanistan and the Prime Minister President of Afghanistan said, we would like to talk with the Taliban. Imagine. So are we to say, no, we don't talk with those who are blood on their hands? Tell me, who among the Iraqi politicians have no blood on his hand? The Kurds, they killed each other in 96. The Shia, they killed each other. The Sunnah, they killed each other. And not only that, Mr. President, we killed all the minorities. We finished with the Jews, we finished with the Assyrian, now only 500,000 Christians remain in Iraq, and with your help, we will get rid of them as well. Sabia Mindai group, there are only 4,000 people left them in Iraq, and believe me, all those people were more lived in Iraq longer than I, who come from a tribal area, or someone who have just immigrated to Iraq then. This is state we to create back Iraq again. This conference will call for such an Iraqi meeting under then the regional countries. This is the give and take. It has to be their interest. Either we'll be sucked into war into Iraq, or we'll accept a compromise. In this sense, it is to their national interest. You have to find interest, no charity in international politics or regional politics. Then they will help. Those who could push and cajole the Kurds, or the Syrian will help the Baathists, or the Saudi help whoever there, the Iranian will help whoever there. They bring us to the table. Unfortunately, if it's left to us Iraqis, with the kind of political leaders you have, believe me, massacres will be the norm. Bosnia will be a joke in comparison what can we do to each other. Some Iraqi, and I will advise the American in that sense, if you think if you withdraw, you will push pressure on us to reconcile, no. We are already preparing ourselves for a civil war, again civil war. The Kurds already started, he forsake a role which I advocated they play. I was hoping I would welcome a secular Kurdish ruler, President Iraq, rather than a religious one, but unfortunately the Kurdish leadership, and especially in Erbil, they rather than playing the balancing role, they are actually playing the bullying role. If you don't give us 17% of the budget, we don't pass the law. And they got the 17%. Why? How? Nobody knows. The regional budget of the North now is more than the Syrian one. And in this sense, what I say, if we bring all these forces together, we will put the blueprint for the new Iraq, for the new compact, as Starabadi said. This new compact drawn by these people, then we will have election, then we will have a constitution, we amend this constitution, but with the way it is now, there's no way. We are playing a zero-sum theory. What a Sunni will get, a Shia will consider this as a defeat. What a Kurdish will get, an Arab will find a defeat. And they are incapable of compromise. They have all these years to compromise, and they are not doing it. Only just before here, I was in an interview about resurgence of violence in Iraq. I said, of course. What do you need for violence? The Kurds were able, the Kurds had no friends except the mountains, they say, were able to destabilize Iraq for 80 years. How on earth, who is that intelligent leader who said to hell with the Sunnis who have the backing of the Arab world, backing of the Sunni world? They will make havoc. Yes, they cannot topple the government, but they will make our life hell. So, did we learn from our past? No, we didn't learn our past. Now, according to this regional conference, international approach, you bring us all together, and this will create a basis for a new Middle East. And I thank you very much. There are so many things, I leave it to your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Hassan. Karim, you wanted to offer a first comment. While you're doing that, I'm going to ask people who want to ask questions, make comments, to line up. And Kubat, I'll go to you right after Karim. Karim?
Thank you. I really appreciate the enthusiasm of Brother Hassan, but unfortunately, most of his talks is unrealistic in Iraq. He mentioned that the Americans brought the Islamists to the power in Iraq. Actually, this is not the truth. The Islamists, especially the Islamic parties in Iraq, they are genuine, and they are. He knows when the Dawa party has been formed and when the ISKI has been formed. And this is the reality that they got it from the Iraqi people in the election, last election, the 2005. This is first. The second one, he's calling for the secularism. I think, if I'm not mistaken, that Hassan himself participated or ran last elections, and he failed to get any votes to participate in the Iraq parliament.
I didn't participate. I didn't stand.
With somebody else, with a small or my small slate in the last. So I believe he's calling for a regional conference. Iraq is actually took a lot of steps forward in democracy and using elections, which is the only mean to define our democracy. Give me any mechanism to define the new Iraq or the new situation in Iraq rather than the elections. We have the constitution. Yes, we the constitution need to be to have some amendments. And actually, the questions in the first panel, the reviewing committee, constitutional committee, made its recommendations, and they raised them to the Iraqi Presidency Council and the Security Council, and they are waiting for political decisions. Disintegrating the Iraqi situation is not in the interest of all Iraqis. I am not sure if it is in the interest of Hassan himself. Actually, we are in good progress, and I believe the Iraqi government doing well, and the Iraqi, as I mentioned, the fabric, social fabric is right now getting a lot better than before. Yes, the sectarian conflicts has been very difficult, and we are in very good situation. The government is doing well, and I think, as I mentioned before, we need in Iraq today and since 2003 a strong carriers, which is the two Kurdish parties, the two the ISKI and Dawa party, IIP, and some other whom believe that they are a real strong carriers for Iraq. Any talking about international conference, regional conference, I believe, is just wasting time, and we have to think seriously about the Iraqi interest right now. Thank you.
Kubat.
The beauty of Iraq is that we can and will constantly disagree on almost every topic. I want to go through a few points that I think that the audience should be clarified on. Iraq is mandated to decentralize, contrary to what Mr. Istrabadi said. And I'm an engineer, not a lawyer, so I'm treading on carefully.
Decentralize, yes, but not to federalize. It's not mandated to federalize. That's what I said.
The Iraqi parliament passed a law, the federalism legislation, that allows for the creation of federal regions with powers exactly similar to the Kurdistan region.
Allows, not mandates. I said it's not mandated. It's allowed, not mandated. I am a lawyer, but I was choosing my words very carefully.
I'm an engineer. But it allows for, and people, if they wish to exercise that right, that's their prerogative. It is not for somebody in Kurdistan to determine whether the South should be one, nine, or three federations. This is why a constitution is so critical. It's up to the people that live in those regions to determine whether they want to be secular or whether they want to live in a more conservative way, whether they want to federalize or whether they want to be ruled from Baghdad. I think that... you also touched on the issue of Khanaqin being under the control of the federal government. Khanaqin is a disputed territory. When something is disputed, it is neither here nor there, it is disputed. And that is, it comes to the problem where I want to address some of the things that Brother Ghassan talked about, which was the lack of compromise and how the Kurds have not compromised. The Kurds have compromised on every major political issue since 2003. The disputed territories is one issue that we have constantly compromised on. Time and time again, this issue gets kicked down the road. It was supposed to be resolved in December of 2007. We agreed for the sake of national unity and not to upset people and our neighbors and others to postpone it to come up with a lasting solution. The 17%, this is a fair request of the Kurdistan Regional Government to get our fair share of our national budget. Oil that is produced in Iraq is Iraq's oil. It is not Baghdad's oil, it's not the government of Iraq's oil, it's the people's oil. So we are entitled to 17% of that. And it's our right to say, if you don't make us feel like Iraqis and give us what we are entitled to, then why should we be Iraqis? This is the little Saddam that I was telling about. When I said in my opening remarks that there is a little Saddam in the back of people's minds, this is the little Saddam that we see. This is the little Saddam that terrifies us. This is the little Saddam that brings back the memories of Anfal, of Halabja, of mass graves.
Calm down,
No, this is the insecurity that we feel as Kurds. When we are not made to feel like part of the system, this is how we react. And that's why we have problems today, because people do not understand the political landscape in Iraq is not what it was in 1970. That nostalgic view has moved on, Iraq has moved on, and our policies to address the issues in Iraq must also move on. Thank you very much.
Next, over here on the right, please. Please introduce yourself.
I'm Emil Kupija, I work for the Czech Embassy.
Could you turn the microphone down a bit? Yeah. No. Just come closer to it.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Hopefully it works. Once more, I'm Emil Kupij, and I work for the Czech Embassy. I would have a very simple question. There was used a term, Iraq should be a reasonable democratic. What does mean reasonable democracy as a message for the new government, new American administration? Thank you.
Who talked about a reasonably democratic Iraq? Rend, would you like to come and respond?
Please.
I use that term because a lot of people say, why should we try for democracy in Iraq? After all, Iraq doesn't have a history of Jeffersonian democracy, and there aren't any Jeffersons in Iraq, and there aren't any Jeffersons in the region. So when I say reasonably democratic, I want to say that it is democratic, although maybe not. The democracy is a process, and even the United States is moving in the democratic trajectory, so that rather than wanting it to be a Jeffersonian democracy overnight, that at least we have the underpinnings of democracy and democratic processes. That's all I meant.
May I address this? Faisal, would you like to add?
Yeah, just very quickly, democracy is not an endpoint; it's a process. The Jeffersonian democracy of which Rend speaks, and I'm no admirer of Thomas Jefferson, was a democracy in which to vote you had to be a white property-owning male. Right. And it took another, a civil war and another 100 years after that, 90 years, 87 years, and another 100 years after that to get civil rights acts and voting rights acts to empower minorities in this country to participate, aside from the constitutional amendment allowing women to vote. So it's a process, and the idea that you're creating a democracy in Iraq tomorrow or in the United States, or in Europe, in some of the cantons in Switzerland, women couldn't vote until the 1980s. So it's a process, and I think this is at least what I mean when I mean democracy. This is why I don't talk about democracy. I talk about democratization. It's a process, not an end point, not a state of being. On the 17%, if I could, I would like to talk, and I'm sorry Qubad didn't stay to hear a response to his point. The reason 17% is not reasonable is this, and I don't mean to speak on behalf of Dr. Ghassan, who certainly doesn't need me, but my view of why it's not reasonable is this. The Kurdish position on the 17% is that they constitute 17% of the population, and therefore they should get 17% of the oil income. Well, the problem with that is if every governorate demands its proportionate share based on population of the national budget of the country, the government in Baghdad will have $0 left. That's why it's unreasonable, my view.
Please, next.
My name is Eduardo Abreu. I'm a researcher here at U.S. Institute of Peace. Thank you for the panel for being here today.
Could you speak closer to the microphone, please?
I apologize if I don't address you correct, but Ambassador Estevani. As we all discussed, the difficult...
I got to keep that for life, so go ahead. You want to call me Excellency, have at it.
As we discussed the difficulties and the relevance of a Iraqi constitution, whether it's representative and who's had the say, et cetera, and structure, I question whether it's a structural issue. Is it, if not federalism, if not democracy as an endpoint per se, is it a structure issue? Can we give it another name? What structure can you suggest that may bridge the realities of the socio-political horizon now and which you envision as true democracy?
I believe, and the polls, it's not that I believe, the polls have consistently shown that the Arabs of Iraq don't want federalism. Now, does that mean that I want to impose a centralized rule on the Kurds of Iraq? Absolutely not. If there is a genius in the constitution of Iraq, it lies in this, that it allows, and it's not unique to Iraq, it allows for an asymmetric relationship between Iraq's various constituents to the central government. And we're not the inventors of this. The same is true in Spain. The Spanish don't use the word. It's anathema to say that Spain is a federal monarchy. But in fact it is, because there are regions of Spain that have autonomy. There are other parts of Spain that are ruled directly by Madrid. So you can imagine this kind of relationship in Iraq. No one wants to impose, despite what my now missing friend Qubad may think, no one wants to impose the old days on the Kurds. But it is possible to conceive, and we will not be the inventors of this, of a situation where the Kurds have their autonomy, their federal region, but the rest of the country might not. Or a set of governorates might come together to form a region, or each governorate might, or some governorates might form a state, and others continue to be ruled by Baghdad. One of my theses is that we have long put the cart before the horse in Iraq. Again, the status of the Kurds is what it is. Even the Tal, the interim constitution, recognized the status of the Kurds and made no attempt to try to reverse the de facto autonomy. In fact, it's recognized that they were a federal region. The problem is that we moved to the constitutional stage in Iraq before there was a national consensus on what that stage should look like. We got to that stage, and in my opinion, contributed directly to the insurgency in 2006 and 2007, without there being a modus vivendi amongst the new political elites in the country. And it was dictated by a foreign agenda, an American agenda for getting the political process underway in Iraq. And these are the fundamental mistakes. I could go on for hours, but I'll stop there.
But Faisal, I remember a certain Ayatollah who also insisted on elections before the constitution, and on a constitution created by an elected government. Karim, I think yes. You probably want to comment on this.
I just would say that the Arabs, they need the federalism as a governing style in Iraq. I wonder that Faisal said that the Arab, they don't need the federalism as a governing style. The Arab needs that, and the constitution also stated that federalism is the governing style in Iraq. Again, the ISKI is called for the nine province federation, and we believe in it. But however, we believe that the Iraqis themselves, the governorates or provinces people, should vote for that. So the federalism itself doesn't mean anything without the approval of the Iraqis themselves in the governorates or in the regions. So this is the notion of the federalism. Federalism is its part, or it is a governing style for Iraq that's in the constitution, but with condition of the approval of the Iraqi people. Thank you.
Please.
Good afternoon. My name is Jason Campbell. I'm with the Brookings Institution. I had a question regarding this latest provincial elections law that's certainly drawn a lot of media lately. And my specific question is that, to my knowledge, it still has one very important hurdle to clear, and that's the Presidency Council, which, as everyone here knows, vetoed the last provincial elections law. President Talabani vetoed it. I've heard some speculation recently that this latest law will once again be vetoed at the Presidency Council, this time not by President Talabani, but by Vice President Adel Abdelmahdi, ostensibly because it got rid of the quotas, or it doesn't include some of the ethno-religious quotas that were present in the last election. And I was wondering, Mr. Karim, if you could comment on that.
Sure. The Article 50 in the law has been dropped.
Karim, could you just speak into the microphone more directly?
It is dropped because just a technical issue. And the Presidency Council will pass the law with notes, with a note talking about Article 50. All parties, all leaders in Iraq, concerned about having the minorities' participation in the provincial councils. So it is a technical one, and the draft in the Council of Representatives wasn't really reached the agreement among the other the parliamentary committee, and even the United Nations envoy was there in the same session, and they asked him to find a draft. Also, they couldn't get that. And the parliamentary committee asked the Electoral Commission to draft a new article regarding the minorities to add it to the law. And right now, the Electoral Commission working on that, and they will raise their recommendation to the parliamentary committee.
Let me go out of order for a moment, if you'll allow me, and get Nazreen, who's been very good to wait in line.
No,
she has special privileges as a panelist.
Oh,
so
thank you.
I should have.
Well, it's very important that I stand here and talk just because it's an important venue, and many important people are taking note of what you're saying. And we as panelists, at least, we should at least be able to bring the correct information and at least provide the full story to the audience. That's my responsibility, at least I feel. There were some remarks that mentioned that I felt compelled to come here and just, I wouldn't say correct them, but at least give my perspective on them. Having lived in Iraq, having been dealing with data, having been working on the ground and being part of many of the negotiations. Three issues that Ghassan mentioned, actually, and I'm sorry to pick on you, Ghassan. I promised you I will before the panel. But I wasn't planning, but you... some of the remarks you mentioned. First of all, the population figure, and Faisal also mentioned it. I just want to inform the audience that the population figure of Iraq, we don't have an accurate population figure in Iraq, and the problem is because we were not able to do census yet. It's too political issue, but the population figure is still used to distribute the country resources to the municipalities, to the ministries, to design the budget. So whether we want it or not, there is a figure that's been used by the Iraqi government. And unfortunately, that figure is inaccurate. And it doesn't represent the whole group. As you know, under Oil for Food program, Iraqi regime, Saddam regime, inflated the figure because he used to use this program to buy food and medicine, and he inflated it as a way of bringing some money back to his pocket. And that's a big corruption issue that we all are aware of. Under that program, I mean, the current Iraqi government or the parliament, when they divide the budget, they use that inflated figure, and then they use the accurate figure that the UN used for Kurdistan at that time, 10 years ago, which is 3.6, as a formula to decide that Kurdish population is less than 17%. Actually, the current unofficial figure of Kurdistan is 4.6, 4.7. Iraqi population figure, unofficial, is 27.5, 28. Now, if you have to be in my position as Minister of Municipality, when we used to sit and distribute the budget to the municipalities, and we used to distribute them immediately, we used to consider population, but also the history and impact of the atrocities of the regime and the special need of the region. Now, if you consider 4,000 destroyed villages, if you consider Anfal, if you consider that Kurdistan, of all the region of Iraq, doesn't have a factory, doesn't have services, just like any other, because of the successive regime's neglect, of course, the Kurds are actually entitled to more than 17%. I just needed to make that population number figure. Now, I'm not sure about this, but I think in the first agreement between the political parties when they made that constitution, that compact, there was a mention of commitment to that 17%. That's one point. The second point I want to mention is really this disputed area. We have to really recognize the history. We keep forgetting the history. The blue line was not established by Kurds. The blue line was established undemocratically by Saddam forces. He expelled people, Kurdish people, from their villages and created that militarized zone. These people came back to their region. So we keep talking about them as disputed, while factually, culturally, they are not disputed. It was the failure of the successive Iraqi government and the parliament, actually, the House of Representatives, to deal with this issue that became such a contentious now. So the third point is really that hurts me more is what Ghassan said, that Kurds has caused problem in Iraq for 80 years. And coming from a person
not
like Ghassan,
we're destabilizing.
Well, that's even worse. Destabilizing Iraq for 80 years. And that's really hurt me coming from you, Ghassan. What would I expect from other people who are not educated or not aware? Iraq was not created by Kurds and Arabs. Iraqs were created by the Brits. We, the three group, were put together by force. We've been accepting to be part of Iraq under recognition of our rights. We cannot accept, especially in this form, in this capital, in this timing, to be called, in this timing of tension in Iraq, that Kurds are destabilizing Iraq. I like you to really consider that remark and remember the role that we played in trying to build the democracy in Iraq, all the sacrifices. We were safe haven for all the other Iraqis who fought Saddam. And all that history, I don't need even to go through it because I know deep down you know it. And I know that you meant this out of, because I expect much more from you. And I want you to help me to pacify the situation instead of adding fuel to it. Thank you.
I very much appreciate Mr. Barwari is one of the highly respected intellectuals in the Iraqi, and she is Iraqi, though today she is speaking as a Kurd. And my friend, he is very good, but he's today representing the Islamic Party, Shia Islamic Party.
I'm always representing that.
Allow me now to defend the Kurds. First, when I say they are destabilizing, when you deny them the right, what do the Kurds will do? Will they clap for you? They will resist. So the Kurds resisted. When they resisted, they destabilized the government. So that is, I said it in a positive sense, but you have the tendency, whatever I will say, no, it should be something else in it. That's one. Okay, the other point. Dear Nasreen, when you start about population, when you start talking about borders, when you start about disputed areas, this is tantamount that you are something and we are something else. We are not sharing the same land. We are not citizens. You are Kurdi, you, I am Kurdi, you are Arabi, and I would say the right thing to be, the right thing, is their independence. I am for the independence of Kurdistan, the three provinces, today, not tomorrow, and the Kurd, the three provinces, will negotiate with Baghdad about the borders. But you cannot negotiate with yourself. You cannot sit in Erbil and you sit in Baghdad and negotiate yourself about the borders. So once you're talking about borders, about percentages, you are exactly remind me of the Israeli and the Palestinian talking about. What's the problem between the Israeli and the Palestinian today? What's the simply they agree on the two states. It's a question, where is the border? Shall we take this or not, this disputed area? What they are talking, population, what do you do with the Palestinian in Lebanon? Exactly what you are talking today exactly reminds me of what the Israeli and Palestinian talk. Are we in this stage? Fine. And that's why you hear it from one who always support the Kurd. Till now I support the Kurd. That good, if you want separation, good for you, good luck. Have your separation and let us discuss exactly what the Czech did in a civilized manner, the divorce, and they negotiated. That will be healthier. This is maybe healthier for the psyche of the Kurd. We have independence. You like any nationalist, you like to have your flag. You like, but until we realize as the European, only you, by denying this selfishness into a bigger entity, they prosper. The other point, in a one word or two, I appreciate the Kurdish fear. But please, I would like to hear someone why the Kurdish demonstration in Halabja were persecuted and some of them killed. Demonstration in Duhok, they were killed. The Islamic Party in Duhok was banned, destroyed. And another demonstration the other day in Erbil, also this. Why I am as an Iraqi, I cannot act politically in Kurdistan. I need to be vouched by someone. They, you know, will tell me because security. We want to make sure you are infiltrator or not. Actually, the trend has gone towards separation. Don't let us fool ourselves. So the best thing, as an Iraqi, you are not in the mood, not you personally. I have more than almost 750,000 Kurds in Baghdad. They would like to remain in Iraq. They have no interest in the transfer like Pakistan and India. But with this mentality, better to have independence and negotiate, but this will be done. But you know this will not happen, not because Iraqi don't like it, not because you don't want it, you will love it, but because you know the international circumstances. Here, one lesson from the history. You said it. History denied the Kurds to have a nation, a state. That's absolutely right. History, again, by the invasion of Iraq, gave the Kurds an opportunity unbelievable, which is they're enjoying. In between, all their struggle, cold struggle, didn't achieve an iota of right to them. All their struggle, with all, exactly like the Palestinian. The Palestinian, all, they were denied to have a state of their own. All their struggle, the Palestinian, didn't achieve them an iota of freedom or independence. Only by peaceful negotiation, only by international community to help them. I am saying this with all respect. This is exactly the Arab nationalist. We kept talking about Palestine, Arab unity, and in the end we are more fragmented, we lost even more than in the past. The Kurds have the right and the privilege to make the same mistakes. But here, that's why when I speak like this with an ordinary Kurd, and there are voices are coming out who can speak freely, they will tell me they cannot have a job unless belong to one of the party. He tells me he cannot have any chances of progress, only the party. The Mukhabarat, the Ashasi, now control different Ashasis, of course. No, so that's why I say independence is the best solution to the Kurds. Thank you.
Hassan, let me ask you to stop there, please. You've been very patient. Thank you.
My name is Stephanie Brancaforte. I used to work briefly at the deeply flawed Iraqi High Tribunal. I was wondering, of all of the distinguished panelists, there was some mention made about Iran's role in Iraq. What are some practical recommendations that you might give to the new administration on how to diminish the influence of Iran in Iraqi politics?
Karima, I look to you in part, yes, and then I think Faisal would like to follow up.
Of course. The leader of ISKI called for a direct dialogue between the United States and Iran. this since February 2007. And we believe in the direct dialogue between the current administration or the next administration with Iran. Because this way, this is the only way we can settle the situation between both and to reflect this on the Iraqi situation as well.
Faisal?
Well, I agree with both Mr. Al-Mousawi and Dr. Atiyah. Number one, I think there should be a direct dialogue between the United States and Iran. And, of course, there were some attempts at that that we in Iraq hosted, in fact.
Yes, four sessions.
I don't think much came out of them. But nevertheless, I also agree with Dr. Atiyah that there should be an international conference. I don't see that as a diminution of our Iraqi sovereignty. It is a practical reality. Our regional neighbors, and the best line on this was uttered by the Deputy Prime Minister of Iraq, Dr. Barham Saleh, who said at the Davos conference that he wished that Iraq were a Pacific island nation, then it wouldn't have any neighbors. But we're not, and we do. And they have interests in Iraq. A particular vacuum was created in Iraq, which they very largely filled. You have daily shellings from Iran into Iraqi Kurdistan. You have daily incursions of Turkey into Iraq in Kurdistan. There has to be some mechanism brought to bring that to bear and to bring that to an end. Now, specifically with respect to Iran. You know, let me answer the question indirectly. One of the mistakes this administration has made, hopefully to be eschewed by the next administration, is in pinning its support for an Iraqi government not to the institutions of Iraqi government, but rather to an individual. And to conflate, to make the term Iraqi government and a particular individual to be terms that are coterminous. This is a huge blunder from an American perspective, never mind that it results in problems in Iraq, such that, you know, others, not I, have been elevating the Constitution to the level of sacred scripture. Okay. When there were constitutional efforts within the Iraqi Chamber of Deputies to create an alternative to the current government, the United States put its not inconsiderable weight behind a successful effort to bring that to a stop. The consequence is that you have a current leadership in the Iraqi government secure in the knowledge that whatever it does, it has the personal backing of the highest levels of the government of the United States. That is as directly as I will answer your question.
Just a minute. My paper is about the election for you, but it's not there, but I said the point followed. You cannot fight Al-Qaeda only with the Sunni, and successfully happened. You cannot fight Iranian influence only with the Shia. When the Shia realize now the Islamic tendencies in Iraq, whether Shia or Sunni, like the swing, they reach at maximum. Now, believe me, there is a tendency against them because they didn't deliver. If there is a free election in the South, believe me now, so many of them will not vote for the Islamists because they didn't get anything. I give you an indication. More than 400 tribal sheikhs from the South, they are Shia, attended a conference by the Mujahideen Khalq in Ashraf Khan. This is, they did it because they are unhappy with how the Islamic Party are running things. There is a tendency among the Iraqis, especially Arab Iraqis, the tribal region. The tribal sheikh are marginalized, trifled. Any young one with a turban, with the money from Iran, he is controlling the scene. The election could give us an opportunity. Will it be fair and free? That's up to you.
I'm going to take... Please. Carry on.
Sorry. Again, Ghassan, actually, it is very hard to explain because Ghassan just denied the reality in Iraq. Iraqi people, Iraqi population is a religious people. This is the truth. And he mentioned that they will change, the Iraqis will change their loyalties to the different factions also. We will have very soon, in the 31st of coming January next year, and we have the December 2009 also annual elections. And we will see the outcomes of the elections. I advise, seriously, I advise my brother Hassan to go to Baghdad and form his own entity to participate in the coming elections, and we will see next time in the USIP as well. This is the truth. Iraqi population is a religious people. They will vote for the Islamic parties. This is the truth, whether in the Sunni side or in the Shia side. If we talk about different than that, I think we will... This is a different issue. This is a different issue. Within the Islamic aspects, there is a different factions. This is okay, that's fine. But the voters, the Iraqi voters, will vote to the Islamic parties.
I think
the
we...
The second one.
Go
Can
ahead.
I go with the second one?
Yeah.
Also, I wondered about the 17% of the courts. If we don't pay if the central government don't pay the 17% from the Iraqi budget, how they live? Why it is too much for the Kurds and they are Iraqis? I'm not defending the Kurds but this is the truth.
Your allies, yes.
What's that?
Your allies, your
Muhammad. Of course. We are I am proud of that. I am proud of to be allies for all Iraqis. I think the 17% is maybe even less than what they should have. It is just a temporary percent, and maybe the next budget they will discuss it after the census for Iraq. If we get a real census for all Iraqi territory, we will distribute the budget for all regions or federations or provinces.
And
otherwise, how they live? It is not the same way or similar to the United States that the state could do itself get its budget for itself. There is no tax in Iraq. There is no tax in Iraq. We have only the oil revenue. This is the truth. I don't know how.
Just a joke. There's a joke with the percentage. They will say, well, I read, a Sunni says we are 60%. A Shia says we are 60%. A Kurd will say we are at 25%. The Assyrian will say, believe me, we have our own arithmetics. It's 200%. And the question of the percentage, Baghdad is 5 million at least, the population. And the whole Kurdistan is 5 million. Imagine if 17% to Kurdish, Basra will have another, believe me, we have to have 200% so as to satisfy everyone.
This is the new Iraq, and this is the federalism. We have to accept, whether we like or not.
You know, the truth of the matter is that revenue sharing questions are very difficult in the United States too, so let's realize that these things can take a while to settle. I'm only going to be able to take two more questions, and Bob, I'll start with you, and then you, and then we'll go back through the panel.
I'm interested in the...
Introduce
this,
yourself.
Oh, yeah, I spoke... It's Bob Dreyfus with The Nation magazine. I wanted Hassan to answer this also, but...
there he is.
Yeah, and perhaps Faisal, you could talk about this. I mean, Mr. Al-Mousawi said that this idea of a constitutional convention is not realistic. Probably most people like me who haven't read the details of Barack Obama's Iraq policy, it's in there. He says he wants to convene an international regional constitutional convention to remake the Iraqi political structure and constitution. He doesn't talk about it in his campaign, but it's there. My question is, is it realistic? I mean, your colleague says it's not. How do you get from no constitutional convention to a constitutional convention when it's opposed by ISKI and PUK and KDP?
Let me take your question as well at the same time.
This is not a question, it's like a statement. My name is Mohsen Al-Adari.
Speak into the microphone, please.
My name is Mohsen Al-Adari. I am Iraqi who participate in the political system since 1956 when I was in first year of law school. I think we have to go to Iraqi society or the Arab society or the Muslim society to know how it's developed. When I came here first to the United States, I took introduction to political science in Villanova University before I go to law school to complete my requirement for the bar exam. And our teacher was conservative American thought. One day he brought to us the true believer for Hoover. And he said, I want you to study this to see if it is can be the way to mass movement in the United States. I told him, I don't know how it's going here in the United States, but I have to explain to you the view in our area, the Arab world, the Muslim world. I told him, before 1958, the prevailing view in the street is leftist, especially the Communist Party who control on the street.
Yeah, I think we have to wrap up.
Okay. Then, after that, came the nationalists, which I was one of them. Then we failed. The people, they cannot stay without thought, without future. Then the Islamists will prevail. How they succeed or not, that is the way when they adopt the political view. And now, if you look at the Arab world, or the Islam world, you found the prevailing view is the Islamists.
Okay.
That's very important. This view, how we deal with the view of the Islamist, we have to try to moderate them to say we are, as my friend Ghassan, here the United States have to do so and so and so. This is not the duty of the United States. This is our duty. Okay. In the Arab, the Islamist in Iraq, where how to deal with this situation.
Thank you very much. Let's stop there. Hassan, I'm going to go back through the panel in reverse order.
The comment was very important to me from a gentleman there. It is the question when you put a deadline that's 15, 16 months, you put yourself in a trouble. I am proposing in my argument with your people and others how you turn your military presence in Iraq from a liability into an asset. The following thing. You have to start from November. You don't wait until. The transitional team have to deal with this issue by reaching for all the regional powers, by reaching with the Russian and others, creating the atmosphere. If the Syrian will find you that you are forthcoming, the Iranian already yesterday mentioned, one of them, Sultani, that we might consider seizing enrichment of uranium. I don't know what's the position of the Iran, but this is, if this conference, the card with the United States government will be, look, you neighboring countries, we would like to withdraw our troops. We need guarantees from you, the neighbors. What sort of Iraq will be there? If we withdraw without these guarantees, how you guarantee you will not be sucked into a civil war, not among Iraqis, but among Iranian, Saudi, Jordanian, Turk, into Iraq? Accordingly, it is to your interest and our interest and the Iraqi interest that we come to a formula how to cooperate in maintaining stability in Iraq without denying you, Iranian, your legitimate role in the area, without denying the Shia, the Sunni, or anyone else. So in this sense, your withdrawal, this is the conditionality, your withdrawal of forces will be your asset in telling the others, work together, we will withdraw our force.
Kerry?
Regarding the international convention, actually we respect Senator Obama's idea, but unfortunately the Iraqis must decide, and that's why we opposed Senator Biden's plan, because it is not an Iraqi plan. Iraqis should decide what they want to do. This is the main issue, and I believe
and I am sure, actually not believe only, that most of Iraqis will oppose the international convention.
Because I don't want to be misunderstood, Mr. Dreyfus. I am not calling for an international conference to draft an Iraqi constitution. That would be disaster. And I don't think that any of us has called for that, and I'm not aware of any Iraqi who has called for an international conference to draft an Iraqi constitution. And if that is, and I am not intending to be partisan, but if that's a part of Senator Obama's proposal, I mean, what does he propose? That we have, you know, Obama of Arabia? I mean, this is a bit too much. We've already had Biden of Arabia, and that, you know, that didn't work terribly well. So the constitution of Iraq clearly has to be an Iraqi document. The problem, in my judgment, is that it was not an Iraqi document to begin with. When the chairman of the drafting committee, who was Sheikh Humam Hammoudi, who is from the Supreme Council, Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq, asked for an extension of time to draft the constitution. He asked for a 30-day extension of time to draft the constitution before anybody in the Iraqi political class responded to the request. The United States ambassador in Baghdad said no. Now, this is absurd. Absurd. So it has to be an Iraqi process. My critique of the constitution itself and the process is it was not sufficiently Iraqi, and there was not a sufficient modus vivendi amongst all Iraqis to get us to a constitutional phase. I believe it's a mistake to draft constitutions early in places like Iraq where there has not been a sufficient time for consensus building. But that's a topic for another day.
I have to cut off. We've had a very stimulating morning. I hope you'll all join me in thanking Rend for organizing and the panelists for bringing us a great deal of wisdom about the past and about possible avenues in the future. Thank you very much.